From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Republican National Convention has come to a close, and President Trump travels to New Hampshire to campaign today. Last night, he formally accepted the Republican presidential nomination in a speech that cast his presidential rival, Joe Biden, as the wrong choice for America.
At the Democrat National Convention, Joe Biden and his party repeatedly assailed America as a land of racial, economic, and social injustice. So tonight I ask you a simple question. How can the Democrat Party ask to lead our country when it spends so much time tearing down our country?
For a look at how this week will shape up with the presidential campaign moving forward, let's bring in Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent. And Tam, the president doubled down on this message as law and order president, the backdrop, of course, being the protests against police violence across the country. He painted the Democrats as giving free rein to violent anarchists and criminals. Did he say anything about police misconduct last night or really outline a way forward on the racial unrest or healing?
Yeah, there was about a half sentence there about police misconduct. He said the justice system must hold wrongdoers fully and completely accountable, and it will. But then he quickly moved on, decrying mob rule, complaining that Democratic-run cities are the problem. In terms of moving forward or dealing with the underlying concerns that are leading to these protests, he didn't really get into that. It was more about saying, you know, we need law and order in our streets.
Yeah. Another big theme was the economy. He jumped from what it was like before the pandemic and what it will be like after the pandemic if he's president. But he glossed over what's happening right now.
Well, you know, that's not a great reelection campaign plan to run on being down, you know, 20 million jobs. That's not the pitch you make. And so essentially what his message is, what it has to be. I mean, he had initially wanted to run on, look at this amazing economy. And then the pandemic came. The U.S. response to the pandemic has not helped the economic situation one bit. And so now he has to run on this idea of, remember what it was like in early March and February. We could do that again, and I'm the best one to get you there. That is his campaign pitch.
You know, something else we heard a lot, especially last night, was kind of the building of him as a character. Throughout the week, employees and family members spoke about how he's a warm, caring person. Last night, his daughter and also presidential advisor Ivanka Trump described her father's reaction as he watched Alice Johnson get out of a life sentence in prison for a first-time nonviolent drug offense after he granted her clemency.
As she ran into the arms of her family and they celebrated a joyful reunion, my father got very quiet. I could see the emotion on his face. After a long silence, he looked at me and said, "Imagine how many people there are just like Alice."
Tam, how central was the crafting of this persona this week?
You know, it was a big part of the four nights. One thing that was very interesting to me is that other than Ivanka Trump, his children actually delivered pretty straight ahead political speeches that were more focused on policy than the person. They weren't the personal validators as much as some of his staff were. But the idea here is to say, President Trump isn't just that guy tweeting in all caps and you know, counterpunching and punching his rivals. And he isn't just that mean, brash guy that you see out there. He's also, you know, a real caring person. The point of that being that there are a lot of people, particularly suburban women voters, that are a key focal point for this campaign, who are completely turned off by the aspects of the president's personality that are most on display. And so part of this convention and all conventions are about, you know, painting a more full picture to say, hey, look, he's a nice guy under there. You just don't get to see it.
You know, now that both of these conventions are over, we're about to be in the thick of the campaigning cycle before November. What did they shed light for us on what we might expect, especially in light of COVID-19?
Well, it's going to be brutal. That's what I can tell you. The campaign is going to be brutal. I mean, if you look at the way both Biden and Trump are presenting this choice in November, they are presenting it as an existential choice, either about the fate of the democracy or about America being America anymore. In terms of COVID, I mean, you saw crowds of 1,500 people on the South Lawn last night, no social distancing, no masks. And meanwhile, the Biden campaign is doing masks and social distancing. So you're going to see a very different approach to in-person campaigning.
That's Tamara Keith, NPR White House correspondent, as always. Thank you so much, Tam.
You're welcome.
Well, since this was a virtual Republican convention, much of the reaction came online. So let's go to Femi Okeh, who's been monitoring social media. She's host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
Well, what were some of the trending topics from the RNC?
A big hashtag that I noticed immediately after the president spoke and leading up to it as well, Trump 2020 landslide, mostly enthusiastic Trump supporters. Ohio gal 330, one of the best presidential speeches I have ever heard, Ohio gal says. And then also, if you look out on social, you'll find the DC protests, which really provided a contrast to what was happening on the South Lawn of the White House, to what was happening outside on the streets. There were tussles with police, tussles with passers-by, and you got a really good sense of that split in politics, in what's happening in America, just from looking at the hashtags and also the videos on social.
Today in Washington, people are gathering to protest systemic racism on the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. It also comes, of course, amid the outrage over the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin. What are people saying on social media about that?
I'm getting this distinct atmosphere as weariness, anger. Here we are again. For instance, there's a list of hashtags. Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, Elijah McClain, George Floyd, hashtag too many to name. Also organizing happening online. So there is a GoFundMe for Jacob Blake's extensive medical treatment to help his family, to help his children. There are calls for people to chip in and help and support him.
There's also been the news after the shooting of Jacob Blake of some protesters there in Wisconsin who were shot. A 17-year-old is in custody for that. And some people online are even showing support for him, perhaps following the lead of people like Fox News' Tucker Carlson, who said this earlier this week.
So are we really surprised that looting and arson accelerated to murder? How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would?
I tweeted this week when I heard that I would have been fired, and rightfully so, if I had said something so stupid as that on the air. But there have been conversations online about Facebook's decision to ban some support pages for this 17-year-old. What are you seeing about that?
There's been a support page for a militia group, a self-described militia group, that has been removed from Facebook. Tucker Carlson wasn't the only person who spoke out saying, well, you know, there's some context here. Ann Coulter was not condemning the alleged shooter. Megyn Kelly was also taken to task on Twitter as well. But what I'm noticing are memes and support for the shooter. I'm deliberately trying not to say his name. This has become a tradition in the media. If you're talking about somebody who has allegedly committed violence, why make them more iconic than they already are? But there are a couple of hashtags here. Hashtag free, name of the shooter. Hashtag name of the shooter, did nothing wrong. There is some support for this young man, and there is pushback, and there are images of him out in the woods holding a gun, and the critiques are coming in saying, this is not normal. This is not right. This young man is a domestic terrorist. So the debate goes on. But it is fascinating to see how, where you feel that there couldn't be a debate about violence, that there absolutely is.
One more thing, Femi, and let's turn to the lighter side because it's Femi Okeh on Fridays. We have to do something fun.
I know. It's a burden sometimes.
Tom Cruise is back at the movies. He went to a movie theater. He posted about it on Twitter. It went viral. Tell us what's going on. Why is this getting so much attention?
People loved it because he was going to the movies to see Tenet, and he was dressed up, wearing a mask, riding through the streets of London. He went to see the film in London. People recognized him. Mr. Cruise, even when his face is half covered up in a mask, he's recognized in the movie theater, social distancing, people with their popcorn, but he is in there. He loves the movies. And everybody just said how great it was to see a kind of little bit of getting back to normal and his enthusiasm for being in a theater. And if Tom Cruise can go to the movie theater, this is the underlying subtext of this, it is safe for everybody. It is not a mission impossible. You can take that away and decide for yourself, but it was a really fun video. You can see it at Tom Cruise's Twitter feed.
Emmy O'Kay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Public transportation agencies have seen ridership and revenue plummet due to the coronavirus pandemic. We'll link you to an online tool that shows what demand is like where you are at hereandnow.org. In the San Francisco Bay Area, demand is down 80%. Jeffrey Tumlin is director of transportation at the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency and joins us now. Jeffrey, in late March, the SFMTA suspended subway and light rail service. Then this past weekend, rail service started up again, but you had to close it down just days later. What happened?
That's right. We had two problems that happened simultaneously. One is we had a splice on the overhead wire in the subway failed early Saturday morning. That screwed up service a little bit. And then 2 days later, we had a scenario happen, which was basically our worst case scenario that we had been planning for from the beginning, which is that one of the people in our transportation management center, the nerve center of all of our transit operations, tested COVID positive. But as a result of that, several people there needed to go out in quarantine, which conspired with the previous incident to make running the rail system way too risky for us. So we retreated back to our place of radical resiliency, which is running an all-bus muni system for the time being.
But isn't that going to be a problem going forward? Don't you have to have enough sort of backup people that can come in case of something like this happening again? What if all of your workers come back in a couple of weeks and somebody gets COVID again?
Well, we have a couple of places of vulnerability in the system where we have small teams of highly technical experts who are necessary to be there to keep the system running. We're looking at different ways of being able to reopen the rail system that are more resilient, but we're stuck with a few vulnerabilities that we need to be very cautious around with regard to our trains.
And in the meantime, what are the downsides of running the system just with buses as opposed to using the trains?
Well, there's one key downside, which is that our trains are longer and therefore have more passenger space than our buses do. And that was the reason why we pushed hard on reopening the rail system. We were targeting trying to get the rail system opened in time for school to restart. And even after school ended up not restarting, we still pushed forward, even understanding the risks. So we will remain capacity constrained while we're running all buses, but our buses are so much more flexible and adaptable than our trains are that this is a really much better position for us to be in given the unpredictable realities of COVID.
Well, and in addition to the fact that kids are not going to school in person there right now, a lot of people are working from home as well. What's your demand like at this moment for public transit?
Demand overall for transit is down about 80%. But on our primary transit lines that serve essential workers, demand is only down about 30%. And demand is by far the highest on our bus corridors, not on our rail corridors. Our subway is oriented to bring office workers to the financial district. And all those big office buildings in downtown San Francisco are empty. Our essential workers are going to our neighborhood commercial districts and big institutions like the hospitals. Those places are not served by our trains. And we're delivering faster, more frequent, and more reliable service on our key bus corridors than the agency has in decades, in part because we have to, because demand is so high among our essential workers, and the geography of essential workers is very different than the geography of office workers who have become telecommuters.
Have you had to reroute some of your bus lines or change the routes of those lines because of who is riding right now? I imagine that if you're talking about essential workers, that also would include low-income workers who might be coming from different neighborhoods. That's right. To different neighborhoods.
We have completely rebuilt the Muni system now three times since March. And we are using our very good data on travel patterns and demographics and equity in order to eke the most productive use out of every single available service hour. So yeah, that has meant significant rerouting of services, taking lines out of the financial district in order to move them into Chinatown, where ridership remains strong. We are continually trying to adjust the system based upon the real needs of people with the fewest mobility choices and the least access to local services in their neighborhoods.
What is going on the revenue side? Because all public transit systems are having serious problems. I read that your agency may be facing a $200 million budget shortfall.
We have a $200 million annual budget shortfall in our operating budget right now. We've been very fortunate that the Federal CARES Act, the federal stimulus money, helped us get through last fiscal year, but that money runs out in December. So starting in January, we need to burn our reserves in order to keep the system running as we shrink everything that we do in order to avoid layoffs. All of our revenue sources, whether it's transit fares or parking fees or parking fines or the city's general fund, our primary revenue sources are down between 75 and 95%. And we expect that to continue for some time.
Are you operating under the assumption that Congress is going to pass more money, another CARES Act or something like it, that will get you through next year if things stay pretty bad in the economy and COVID sticks around?
What we're hearing from Washington is not to expect any additional federal funding unless there is a shift in the balance of power that happens in the November election. So we are trying to cut everything that we can to survive.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned that ridership might never return to pre-pandemic levels? Because this is going to get a lot of people used to the idea of working at home and get a lot of businesses used to the idea of their employees being at home, and maybe they'll never need to go back to the office.
Well, having folks work from home is actually fine for the San Francisco transportation system. One thing that we can't handle is people fleeing to the perceived safety of driving alone. The San Francisco street system cannot handle any more cars on it than it did back in January. Whether somebody is on Muni or on a bike or on a scooter, they take up one-tenth of the street space as driving alone in a car or take an Uber or Lyft. Our job as a transportation agency is to support the economy, to advance equity, and to make the most productive use of our limited public right-of-way in order to serve the larger goals of San Francisco.
Well, one of the things that you've done there is something called the Slow Streets Program, closing certain streets to traffic to open them up for pedestrians and for bikes. Do you think that's going to last beyond the pandemic, to have street closures and make the city a little more friendly for pedestrians and bikes and scooters and stuff like that?
I think the most popular program that the SFMTA has implemented in its entire history may well be our Slow Streets program. It's getting a 90% approval rating, which, like, I didn't think 90% of San Franciscans would agree on anything, let alone change to the transportation system. all of the work that we're doing right now is mostly under the emergency directive, and we are required by law to remove those projects 100 days after the emergency directive expires, unless we take action to change those programs or make them permanent. So we are starting our work right now on evaluating what of these many, many experiments we're doing, which of it should continue.
Have you found that this is an opportunity to, for you to do any kind of long-term infrastructure work that you might not have been able to do before because the trains were full of people and now you can because they're not?
Yes. So during most of the COVID shutdown period, we were not allowed to do the kind of deferred maintenance work that we really wanted to. It was not allowed by the health directive. Now we're at this stage of economic reopening, and now that the health department has given us clear guidance on some of our work programs, we're actually wondering if this new rail shutdown will allow us finally to reinvest in our subway infrastructure and take care of decades of deferred maintenance in the tunnel.
I want to ask you about one more thing, because you're also in charge of taxi regulation for the city and county of San Francisco. What do you see as the future of taxis and Uber and Lyft after all this is over? Because their business models have been thrown upside down as well.
That's right. Uber and Lyft's business model has always been a race towards autonomy. About half of their operating costs is the driver. And so in order for them to really thrive financially, they've got to get rid of their operators. The taxi industry, however, is very different. And the future of the regulated taxi industry has got to be really about customer service. It's got to be about the fact that taxis will continue to be operated by humans. And a lot of travelers really rely on the fact that taxi cabs are driven by a human operator. And so part of our work is to change the regulatory approach to taxis in order to emphasize customer service and correct for some of the inequities that many of our taxi riding passengers have experienced in the past.
But you think that there is a future for taxis in an Uber and Lyft world?
I firmly believe there's a future for taxis if they emphasize customer service.
That is Jeffrey Tumlin, who is Director of Transportation at the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So you hear that sound? That is the sound of about 1,500 people gathered together in a crowd, something many of us haven't heard or experienced for some time. But that was the scene last night on the South Lawn of the White House as President Trump accepted the Republican Party's nomination. No one was social distancing and very few people were wearing masks. Let's talk more about this with Dr. Amesh Adalja of Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Dr. Adalja, could this be a super spreader event? What are the chances that no one got infected last night?
I think the chances that there was no one there that was harboring the virus are very low. We know that when you have over 1,000 people gathering together in the setting of a pandemic, that there's likely to be somebody that's harboring the virus. And it's hard to know ahead of time what's going to be a super spreader event and what isn't, but certainly there is a formula for a super spreader event there with over 1,000 people, people not social distancing, people not wearing face covering. So I would not be surprised if we see cases linked to this gathering at the White House.
Well, what did you think when you saw that?
Well, I think it really just underscores the fact that there are many people in the country that do not believe or do not really take recognition of the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic, and that if you don't act like you're in a pandemic, you're going to face the consequences. We can get together with people, but you have to take some simple common sense measures like social distancing, wearing a face covering, trying to avoid crowded spots. We have to change the way we behave. It doesn't mean we have to stay at home all the time, but it means we have to try and reduce the harm the virus is causing. And this clearly isn't an example of that.
Well, and I also wonder about the message it sends to people who have been trying to social distance and wearing masks, and they wear masks when they walk out in the street and they don't gather together in big crowds. I mean, where I am, you can't even have a dinner reservation outside with more than six people, which seems to make sense from the health perspective. But what message does it send to people when they turn on the TV and they see President Trump in front of a crowd of 1,500 people not social distancing and not wearing masks?
It's another one of the mixed messages that have really been emblematic of the administration's response to this virus from the start. And it does basically defeat the purpose of social distancing if you're still having mass gatherings, because that's going to spark chains of transmission likely. And that's going to erase whatever benefit each individual is doing if you end up getting chains of transmission started that end up creating surges in hospitals, put demand on testing. All of that really doesn't fit with how you operate during an infectious disease emergency.
When you look at the overall picture in the United States right now, and we, you know, we see the graphs, and it does seem like the numbers of cases and deaths are coming down, do you see us sort of continuing to move down in the United States, or do you think there's a possibility we'll see another spike this fall?
I think what we're going to see is a seesaw effect. You're going to see certain parts of this country get control of the virus, other parts lose control of it, and it's going to be like that probably until we have a vaccine, because there clearly is just not a national plan for how to deal with this. So each state is kind of doing it on its own, and you're going to see some states lose control, like we saw in Florida and California or earlier on this summer, and some states maintain control. So I do think that it's hard to actually look at those numbers and say what it means, because it's one snapshot, and we know that these types of pandemics can slip out of control very quickly.
Dr. Amish Adalja of Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And today, health officials in North Carolina say four people have tested positive for COVID-19 after gathering at the convention center in Charlotte on the first day of the RNC on Monday.
Each year, a group of Hurricane Katrina survivors gather in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, a place where the levees blew around this time 15 years ago.
So when I say we have not forgotten, you say we have not forgotten. We have not forgotten.
We have not forgotten.
We have not forgotten.
They read the names of the lives lost, more than 1,800, and share their own stories about the day. Robert Greene Sr. is there every year, too, except for the period when he lived in Tennessee after the storm. He's been a resident of the Lower Ninth Ward since he was 12 years old, and Robert Greene joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Robert, even if people have never been to New Orleans, they know the name the Lower Ninth Ward because this is a place with such a rich history, and it's also the place where the flooding was the worst. Take us back to the Lower Ninth Ward before the storm. What was it like?
Before the storm, we were a closely knit community. I walked to school every morning. On my way to school, I would pick up my other classmates, and everybody knew everybody. I could tell you every one of my neighbors' names. And it was such a community that basically we were a landlocked community. And what that means is we had no room for improvement. We had houses, we had families, we had schools, we had churches. We had everything that you could expect in a community. But we also had a large number of black ownership. It was 99% black owned. And most of the families had lived there. As we came in 1967, they had been here years and years and years before. So we were new neighbors to this community. It was a very tight-knit community.
Yeah. You've shared your Katrina story thousands of times, and every time you've said it gets just a little bit easier. When the evacuation order went out for Hurricane Katrina, you and your family were actually on the road to Tennessee, but your mom was sick, so you all had to turn around and you guys went to the Superdome where people were sheltering, but you were turned around there too, so you had to return home. What happened that night?
When we came home, basically, we weren't afraid. We never expected to have to fight 25 feet of water. We had been through hurricanes before. We had been through Betsy. We had been through Camille. So we knew the danger, but we didn't know the extent that the danger would put us in. And basically, we lived in our fate. We believed that we would be all right. And having three grandbabies, having my 73-year-old mother, having my 60-year-old cousin who was mentally challenged with us, we weren't afraid of what would happen, but we were conscious of the fact that it could be dangerous. So we expected maybe we might have a couple of trees falling, not on our house, but on other places. We expected to have some roof shingles blown off, but we never expected to have to face 25 feet of water and actually have to get into the attic, then get onto the roof of the house and float away. So those things were unexpected. But at the same time, we knew the danger could be there.
And that danger was there. You lost.
Yes.
You lost your mom. You lost some of your grandchildren.
Yes.
This is a tremendous amount of loss. What are you reflecting on today, 15 years later?
15 years later, actually, we're reflecting on celebrating their life, reflecting what my mother instilled in me, this sense of family. We are going to celebrate their lives. My two granddaughters who was with us at that particular time are now in college together. They endured the storm together, endured coming back together. But the idea is we have so much to be thankful for. And although Katrina took a lot from us, it also showed us the value of family. It also showed us the value of help that came from everywhere. Volunteers who didn't think anything about themselves, but only about helping. So it showed us that even though we may have felt left alone, we were never alone. We were never left by ourselves. We always had someone who cared about us. So for us, it's a sense of fulfillment tomorrow. My family will be here, and we will second line. We will have Faya singing, calling on the people to come back home. We'll have the Mardi Gras Indians. We'll have a second line band, but we'll have community and doing the things that we've done in the past. We're not going to forget what happened that day, and we're not going to cry tomorrow. We're going to celebrate their lives. We're going to celebrate the community. We're going to celebrate the possibility of having a great future in spite of what's going on right now with the COVID.
And I want to talk to you more about that celebration, that call to home for the diaspora, all of those people from New Orleans who now live in other places throughout the country who call those places now home. But you've got to be a really proud granddad. You've got grandchildren in college now.
Yes. Besides grandchildren in college, I have a great grandbaby who just made 1 year old. I have grandkids, 10 of them, to be perfectly honest. And what it is we really are looking forward to tomorrow. Looking forward to the future, looking forward to those kids growing up. I have a daughter who just recently bought a house, who got married. She has a baby. So life goes on, and we're looking toward the future, and we're looking towards the happiness of realizing that the tragedy was something that happened, but the tragedy has not stopped us from enjoying and living our lives.
Yeah. So Cess45, a local rapper, and your friend who always organizes the annual Katrina March and Second Line that you're talking about, which will happen tomorrow on Saturday, says that this celebration is, it's also about demanding justice for the way that the Bush administration seemed to turn a blind eye to New Orleans, especially Black New Orleans. But the theme for tomorrow, as you said before COVID hit, was calling on the people to return home. What does this theme mean for you to have folks think about New Orleans as a place that they want to come back to?
Well, what we were doing when we were starting that wasn't so much but giving people that helped us a chance to be recognized for the great value that they brought to our lives. And then we also wanted our residents who couldn't come back to realize there is something here more than there was at the time Katrina hit. Fortunately for me and my family, we were much older, my kids, so the risk to them wasn't as great for us to come back. But there were families who had children who had to worry about the toxic nature of what was going on outside, the lack of schools, the lack of economic development after that. So we had a lot of families that needed to know that we're on the way back and we want them to come back. And we also want other families to help us to replenish our community by coming in as well and not saying we only want the families that lived here before. But we need people to realize that we can move forward. They can come back. They can have the lives that they had before, and they can have a good life here as well.
And in true New Orleans fashion, as you said, Robert, there'll be no tears tomorrow. It's celebration. And so we will go out on some second line music from a past anniversary. And if you've never seen a second line, you can tune into the live stream of tomorrow's event. We'll put the link up at hereandnow.org. And you might even see Robert and Cess 4-5 and all of your grandkids out there honoring the lives of those lost and those still living. You said they'll all be there.
Oh, yes, they'll all be there. They'll all be there in our Rooftop Riders t-shirts, from the little babies to my granddaughters that are in college, to my sons, to my children, to my neighbors, to our community. We'll all be out here tomorrow. There won't be any crying. There won't be any wooing. We'll be dancing in the streets. We'll be singing our songs, and we'll be enjoying life because life goes on.
Robert, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
In the run-up to the election, we're looking at Senate races across the country. This week, we check in on an open Senate seat in Kansas. That's where Democratic State Senator Barbara Bollier and Republican Congressman Roger Marshall are facing off. Jim McLean is chief political reporter at the Kansas News Service out of KCUR. He's in Topeka. Hi, Jim.
Hey, hi, Jeremy. Good to talk to you again.
Good to have you back. And the seat is open after Republican Pat Roberts said he would not seek re-election. And let's talk about the candidates. Democrat Barbara Bollier left the Republican Party in 2018. She said after then Republican Governor Sam Brownback's very controversial tax cuts that led to big cuts across the state. Here's a recent ad from Bollier.
As the party turned its back on Kansas values, I turned away from that party and became a pragmatic Democrat. But the truth is, as a doctor, I've never really been about partisan labels, just problem solving. And we need more of that right now.
What more can you tell us about Barbara Bollier?
Well, to start with, Jeremy, she's a physician, as is Marshall. She's a retired anesthesiologist. And she, as you mentioned, and as you the clip pretty much reveals, she was a member of the Kansas State Legislature for several years, being elected year after year as a moderate Republican, when moderate Republicans frankly held sway at the state house. And then, as you pointed out, she left the Republican Party after the 2018 election, became a Democrat, and is now the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate. And she's trying very hard at every turn, as you heard in that campaign commercial, to present herself to Kansas voters as a pragmatic person, a moderate, a voice, an independent voice who can work across the aisle. And interestingly, her first two ads of the general election cycle feature Republicans talking about why they're going to vote for her.
Does she talk about Trump at all? Does she criticize him?
She really doesn't, not very overtly. Privately, of course, she does. And she was very outspoken about former Governor Sam Brownback and the tax cuts that led to essentially a lot of financial difficulty in Kansas and were eventually repealed. Bollier among those voting to repeal them. But so far in the campaign, she has not targeted President Trump. Of course, President Trump carried Kansas by almost 20 points and still leads even now over Biden by about 12 points.
The Republican is Congressman Roger Marshall. You spoke with him this week and asked him if he felt there was systemic institutional racism in the United States, if that's a problem. Here's his answer.
I do not see that in Kansas. Come to my house at night for dinner, and you'll see there's not systemic racism in the Marshall household. But regardless, do I see problems in Wyandotte County in Kansas, that I don't think that those kids are getting the education that they need and deserve? Is there opportunity for improvement? Absolutely. Are there some bad police officers out there? Yes, but I also believe that 99% of police officers are great people, that these are the people that I grew up with. The people.
What should we know about Roger Marshall, and what has his record been?
Well, just picking up on that audio clip, Roger Marshall grew up in a small town near Wichita, where his dad was the chief of police. And so that's why he makes that reference to the people he grew up with. He's been an obstetrician in western Kansas, in Great Bend, Kansas, for many, many years. Ran for Congress 4 years ago and defeated a guy named Tim Huelskamp, who was kind of a Freedom Caucus rabble-rouser. And Marshall beat him, somewhat posturing himself as a moderate, which means when the Senate campaign, particularly the primary, running against former Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who was a very much a conservative, Marshall had to play down, rather kind of counter the narrative that he was a moderate Republican, and talked a lot about how in the House he votes 98% of the time with President Trump. So he's had to really play up his fidelity to President Trump, both in the primary and so far in the general.
Does he have much of a relationship with the president at this point? You mentioned that primary. A lot of people thought that if Kobach had won, it would have been a very difficult race for the Republicans to win.
Exactly. Kobach, of course, was endorsed by President Trump when he ran for governor in 2018, losing that race to Democrat Laura Kelly, which is why many Republicans were nervous about nominating him for this Senate seat, which they've held since 1932 in Kansas. And so they were nervous about nominating Kobach. Kobach, of course, had a relationship with President Trump, probably still does. But the president did not endorse in the Senate primary, and Mitch McConnell and others worked very hard to keep him from doing that. Marshall claims to have a relationship with the president, and of course, in all of his campaign ads, they're pictured side by side.
So let's get to the big question, what might happen in the Senate race? The polls seem like they're pretty close.
Yeah, we had a poll August 12th, a Survey USA poll that was a good poll, robust poll, 3.3% margin of error, that showed the race statistically tied. Marshall 47%, Beaulieu 45%. And some very interesting information when you tab through it. You know, a lot of political scientists will argue there's no such thing as an independent voter. They either lean Republican or lean Democrats. And those left-leaning or Republican-leaning or Democrat-leaning voters do tend to stick with either Marshall or Beaulieu, depending on whether they're Republicans or Democrats. But the poll says true right-down-the-middle independents, Beaulieu leads among that group, 62% to 18%, so 44-point lead in that independent voting group, which could be a key to this race if it's really that close.
That is Jim McLean, chief political reporter at the Kansas News Service out of KCUR. Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.